Well, welcome everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. It's great to see all of you. I'm glad that you're back for another round of constitutional conversations. This is the fifth and final program in this series. We'll email you to indicate when we're going to start again, but we'll take a break for a couple of weeks and we'll let you know. And I know you don't mind taking a break because it gets pretty intense to be talking about all these very serious issues. So stay tuned as to our return date. I want to thank KISU for rebroadcasting this program and to thank all of our sponsors, including the Carr Foundation and the Bank of Idaho, and also Channel Blend, and a number of very, very generous individuals. Thanks to everybody to make this programming possible. Tonight, we want to cover a broad spectrum of issues tied to the Russian investigation. Maybe you've heard about that a little bit. It's been in the news once in a while. And you know that there were 13 indictments last Friday handed down by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And it suggests very strongly that Mueller's investigation is really pulling the strings pretty tightly around a number of people who worked in Russia to meddle in the 2016 elections and perhaps worked in concert with people on the Trump campaign. That's the part that has to be nailed down. But the indictments are coming pretty quickly now. We had just today the deputy director of President Trump's campaign team who entered a plea of guilty and now is cooperating with Mueller. So the investigation is sweeping. It is now permeating not only the United States but European countries. Concerns about money laundering, bank fraud, looking at the interconnections between the people on the Trump campaign team and the administration. So it's clear that the investigation undertaken by Special Counsel Mueller has come a long way. Of course, we don't know what Mueller knows. And so some of these indictments, some of the guilty pleas, some of the cooperative witnesses will often surprise us, and it suggests that the investigation is both expanding and tightening. So it's almost the case that on a daily basis now, we're learning more about the investigation undertaken by Robert Mueller. We want to talk a little bit about Mueller's security today, particularly in light of the number of calls from conservatives in Congress who want him removed, threats by the president against Special Counsel Mueller if he strays too far from what he's supposed to be investigating, although what he's supposed to be investigating may not be in line with what President Trump would like to have him investigating. So there's the Mueller investigation. We want to talk a little bit about the congressional investigation, particularly the investigative powers vested in Congress by the Constitution. But I really want to begin tonight by drawing your attention to a New York Times column written by Tom Friedman just a couple of days ago that has triggered a great deal of national conversation about President Trump. And for those of you who are not familiar with Tom Friedman, he is slightly right of center, so he's not a flaming liberal by any means. And he begins this column with a very stark warning that Donald Trump is the gravest threat to American democracy. That's a pretty powerful way. It grabs your attention if you're a reader of newspaper columns. And what he goes on to set forth in his column is his argument that President Trump is either completely owned by Vladimir Putin and the Russian oligarchs, or in Friedman's view, he is a towering fool. Now, why might Friedman's words, not mine. But we would ask, why might Mr. Friedman say such things about President Trump? It has everything to do with the fact that to this day, President Trump has yet to say anything critical about Vladimir Putin, anything critical about the Russian oligarchs, anything critical about the fact that the Russians meddled in our 2016 election. You may recall that since his election, he has denied that the Russians meddled in our investigation, claiming that it is a hoax. And of course, that claim no longer holds any water at all, if it ever did, because we've got the indictments of 13 Russians and 3 Russian organizations. So it's Friedman's claim that President Trump's unwillingness to say anything critical about President Trump represents the fact that either he is owned, that is controlled by the Russians, or he is being very foolish. What would the foolish part entail, perhaps, that in fact President Trump believes Vladimir Putin's denial of any meddling, even though all 17 of the U.S. intelligence agencies concluded a long time ago that in fact the Russians did meddle. So which is it if it's either? It seems more likely, according to Friedman, that President Trump is subject to some control by the Russians. By the Russians, he says, because he is deeply in debt to the Russian oligarch. And here he cites Don Jr.'s statement back in 2008 that, in fact, most of the Trump empire's debts are to Russian banks and Russian oligarchs, which seems to suggest that he might be manipulated, that is, subject to Russian influence. So though that column, which ends with the clarion call to action, that in fact this is code red. In America, we are at code red, is very important for our purposes tonight, because if in fact President Trump is unwilling to take any actions that recognize Russian meddling in 2016, but more importantly, unwilling to take any actions that would prevent the Russians from meddling in the 2018 elections, which, as you know, are just around the corner, then it raises a major constitutional issue for us. The president takes an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution of the United States. If the president is not taking actions to protect the country, to protect the Constitution from our major adversary, a country which is not democratic, a country which has been dedicated to the effort to sow the seeds of discord and chaos in the United States, then there is a very strong case to be made that the president is failing to carry out one of his principal duties under the Constitution. And that would raise the issue of what sort of sanctions or punishment could be imposed upon the president for violating his oath of office, for refusing to protect the country against another round of Russian meddling, which, by the way, you may know, the chiefs of the intelligence agencies just last week all testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee that they fully expect the Russians to continue their efforts to meddle in our elections. And what that means, of course, is there's an ongoing attack on American sovereignty. There's no other way to describe this. One of the most fundamental rights that we have in our democracy is the right to choose our own leaders without foreign intervention, without foreign influence. And that's why the attempt by other nations to meddle in or to influence the outcome of our elections is in fact a federal crime, which is exactly why Robert Mueller indicted, as we've said, 13 individuals and 3 organizations in Russia. Why should we be concerned about an effort to undermine or influence our elections? Well, it is, number one, a violation of our territorial sovereignty. That is to say, it threatens our very independence as a nation. Number two, it is a grave threat to our democracy, because in a democracy, the American people have the right to choose their own leaders free of influence by a foreign adversary. And what we saw in 2016, and we've just seen again in light of the tragic shooting in Florida, was that the Russian accounts, the Russian organizations, the creation of the bots, the systematic, automatic exploitation of any issue that divides America, and the issue of gun regulation is a major one. So we saw the Russians filling up Facebook and social media and other outlets as soon as the news broke about this horrific shooting. President Trump then steadfastly refuses to establish any interagency committee or commission. He has refused to arraign the leaders of our intelligence agencies, FBI, CIA, National Security Agency, and others, to ask them to come up with a plan to counter the Russians. And he refuses to do this because in his mind, when he hears that the Russians meddled, he automatically thinks that means that his election to the presidency is illegitimate. He can't separate the fact of meddling from the question of how influential the meddling was. Nobody is saying at this point, because there cannot be any conclusive studies done at this juncture, that the meddling amounted to handing the election or the victory to President Trump, even though people examining the issue are drawing that conclusion more and more frequently. Imagine if, in fact, we learn at some juncture that the confluence of a number of events, including Russian meddling, did, in fact, place Donald Trump in the White House when the preference of the American voters was Hillary Clinton. I should say we already know that the preference of American voters was Hillary Clinton because she won 3 million more popular votes. But, of course, we operate on the Electoral College. But imagine the big blow to American democracy once studies begin to draw conclusions, or if studies draw those definitive conclusions that, in fact, the person sitting in the White House is there by illegitimate and fraudulent intervention. That's exactly what Donald Trump fears, and that's why he cannot dissociate the term meddling from the legitimacy of his election. So lacking a willingness by the president, who takes an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and to engage in actions to provide for our common defense, who's going to pick up the cudgels to do exactly that? How many months away are we now from the November election? 9 months or so? It would have to fall on Congress then to engage in an action to try to ensure that elections at the local and county and state levels are not exploited, not controlled, not undermined by Russian meddling. The same would hold true of statewide elections, congressional elections, as well as Senate elections. But Congress is not acting yet. No action by our leadership to protect us from foreign attack. And if you consider that this attack on America in the 2016 election, all but certain to continue now, means that this act of war against our nation, undertaken in 2016, is being met with no resistance by our leadership. It's almost unthinkable, isn't it, to be able to say that our leadership is not doing anything to protect our country. The president is not, the congressional leadership, Speaker Ryan, Senate Majority Leader McConnell, neither individual has undertaken any effort to protect us against another round of interference with our election. That represents a very frightening possibility, then, that the outcome of the elections will not reflect American preferences. You don't have to endure that very often or very long before we say that the very essence of our democracy, the principles, the fundamentals of our democracy begin to melt away. What is an American populace to do when, in fact, we are confronted with the facts that our leadership in the two political branches of government, the executive and the legislative, are doing nothing to protect us? What are we to do? The first thing that we can do is to be educated on the vast, very sweeping powers of Congress to carry out its constitutional mandate to provide for the common defense, as Article 1 indicates, and to assert our voices, raise our voices, demand that our representatives in Congress begin to take action, to say, this is not a partisan issue. Indeed, this is not a partisan issue. This is the essence of American democracy under attack. So wherever we would find our congressional representatives, at restaurants, in town hall meetings, at Lincoln Day dinners, wherever you find them, it's very important to ask, why aren't you doing anything to protect us against another round of Russian meddling in our election? If you have their home phone numbers, give them a call. They would be happy to hear from you. Visit their offices. Write letters. So that's one thing we can do. But we need to be able to indicate that we have a knowledge about the broad powers of Congress so that they can't say, this is not a congressional responsibility. We don't want them to slip off the hook of responsibility. So here's what we say to them. Look at Article 1 of the Constitution. In clear, explicit language, it provides Congress shall have power to provide for the common defense. If providing protections against further meddling in our election is not an exercise of that function to provide for our common defense, because it's a defense against an act of war, I don't know what is. So that's the first thing to note. The second thing is the Supreme Court has held that the investigative power of Congress to investigate almost any nook and cranny in American society, from corporations to NCAA basketball to any other action, is sweeping with very few exceptions. Why did the framers of the Constitution vest in Congress such sweeping investigatory powers? Because they understood that in order for Congress to pass laws and to enact policies to govern the country, that Congress needed access to information. The best way to procure that information would be to hold hearings, to conduct investigations, call relevant witnesses before them. For those who would refuse to answer questions, Congress, the Supreme Court has said, enjoys a broad subpoena power so that witnesses with information and insights cannot be allowed to slip away. So we would say to our members of Congress, if they deny that Congress has the authority to tackle this question, we could say, well, you're wrong. We see the power to provide for the common defense. We would say also that you have the broad investigatory power. The only exception on the kinds of questions that Congress can ask of witnesses is simply that the questions must be germane. They must be pertinent to the exercise of a constitutional power. In this case, the power to make laws is so broad that Congress is allowed sweeping authority to ask questions. There are a number of committees that could be undertaking this. Many committees in both the House and the Senate. the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, to be sure, the Committees on Foreign Relations, on Intelligence, the Armed Services Committee could do it. Such is the nature, the breadth of this threat against America, that it entails the jurisdictional responsibilities of numerous committees in both the House and the Senate. When we ask about the responsibility of Congress to undertake the exercise of its authority in this area, and perhaps the reluctance of the White House to cooperate, then we turn to the question of the power of Congress to force the White House to act. Here we have seen, fortunately, historically, that the Congress, the Supreme Court has said, has broad powers to require members of the administration to testify, to provide information. In United States versus Nixon in 1974, the famous Watergate tapes case that actually brought down the Nixon presidency, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous opinion written by Chief Justice Warren Burger, a Nixon appointee, held that the president's claim of executive privilege to withhold information, including tapes or documents or memos, is sharply limited and may not be invoked to frustrate an investigation, a criminal investigation being led by a special prosecutor or the request by Congress. So the Supreme Court has rendered decisions that uphold the broad power of Congress to conduct the investigation. If the White House or the administration as a whole refuses to cooperate, then Congress, the Supreme Court has said, could issue a subpoena. It can even threaten articles of impeachment. The power of impeachment is the ultimate way of bringing an errant president to heel. Let's think about why the framers of the Constitution included the power of impeachment. In their discussions in the Constitutional Convention, they ultimately arrived at language that provided that the president may be impeached and removed from office for treason, bribery, and a category called high crimes and misdemeanors. This is a very broad category that the framers borrowed somewhat from English law. In their discussions, the framers realized that elections should control the removal of people from office, but there might be those dire circumstances, even emergencies, where the only way to protect the republic would be for Congress to intervene and exercise the awesome power of impeachment. The framers referred to the impeachment power as, quote, the grand inquest of the nation. The grand inquest of the nation. Summoning the great legislative powers to protect the country against an overweening executive, who, in their views, might engage in a number of actions falling into these categories of treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. Among those acts, treason would be a despicable act because it is selling out the integrity of the nation. It is denying the process, the procedure of governance. It is ignoring the constitutional allocation of power. Treason was a heinous act, the framers believed, and anybody, whether it's a president, a vice president, a cabinet member, a member of a federal court, would deserve to be impeached if, in fact, they engage in treasonous actions. A treasonous action would be warranted, a charge of treason would be warranted, if we find, for example, that we have a president or a vice president working hand in hand with a foreign adversary who is trying to undermine our electoral process. Now, that's a pretty strong statement that I made, but I think that's very accurate. I think it's true, because it's the act of selling out our process to a foreign adversary And perhaps in return for something, what might be that something? It could be in return for something to come, or it could be undertaken in return for something that has been done for that president. If a president, for example, borrowed a very large sum of money, and the debt required to pay it off is political action, policies, negligence, indifference to the actions of the adversary, let's say it's Russia, then that is repayment of the debt. We would call that bribery. We would call that treason, as strong as that word is. Tom Friedman, in his column, was speculating that perhaps, as reflected in the Steele dossier, which was way back when, used as one of the many elements to begin to conduct the investigation. Christopher Steele was the former agent of the British government, widely acclaimed, who had worked with the U.S. government on many occasions. The one possibility in that dossier, which has been withheld from the public but said to be in there, would be very damning videotapes of the president engaged in intimate actions that would bring big embarrassment to him, major embarrassment, and it would be so bad that he would do a lot of things to avoid the exposure of those tapes. Friedman is speculating that that might be a reason. But whatever the reason is, if a president refuses to take action to stop the ongoing meddling in our elections, we ask, what's the motive? What's the rationale? We could look back historically, and I think you might agree with me, I can't imagine any previous American president who, having been informed that our greatest foreign adversary has interfered with our election, Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, would have refused to take action to protect against the country. You can pick your least favorite president of all time, the person whom you least liked, and ask yourselves, can you believe that that least favorite president would have failed to take action to protect the nation against a foreign adversary? I cannot, as I think about those presidents that I at least least admired, whatever I thought were their deficiencies or their weaknesses, I cannot summon the name of even a single president who would not have acted, who would not have arranged for a commission to be set up to examine policy reaction, programs, to go on the offensive, which in many cases is our best defense. If you watch football, you know the best defense is a good offense occasionally. I can't imagine another president, and yet we have a president who has refused to do it, no indication that he's likely to do it. That's a betrayal of the oath of office. When you look at that other category of an impeachable offense, high crimes and misdemeanors, we would ask, why did the framers include this? At first, in their discussions in Philadelphia in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, George Mason of Virginia, who would play a great role in writing and subsequently writing the Bill of Rights, suggested that, in fact, the concept of maladministration should be an impeachable offense. His friend, James Madison from Virginia, said there's something to that, but that category is too vague, a little too broad. We need to narrow it so that it has some content. We narrow it, he said, by offering a number of actions or offenses that would warrant impeachment. Negligence of duty, said James Madison, and others echoed that. Negligence of duty, that would include a failure to carry out the president's duty under the Take Care Clause, to that the president has the duty to, quote, take care to faithfully enforce the laws of the United States, including the Constitution. A failure to enforce all the statutes, the failure to enforce or defend or preserve the Constitution, the framers believed, would constitute negligence in the extreme and represent an impeachable offense. A president who might take money or compensation from a foreign government in the form of a gift, a salary, a loan, that would deny him the ability to act in the nation's interest, they believed, would constitute an impeachable offense, falling under that category of high crimes and misdemeanors. By the way, we're not talking about criminal acts. The framers severed criminal acts from impeachable offenses. Criminal actions, theft or robbery or assault, would be handled by the world of criminal jurisprudence, courts enforcing statutes that outlaw robbery or theft or assault. Criminal acts belong to another world. The framers had in mind political acts that constitute high crimes and misdemeanors, a phrase that they borrowed from ancient legal history, in ancient English legal history as far back as the 14th and 15th centuries. High crimes and misdemeanors, then, would the commission of a high crime or misdemeanor, the framers agreed, would constitute an impeachable offense. It would include subversion of the Constitution, subverting federal laws, subverting constitutional terms, a failure to live up to the oath, usurpation of power, the aggrandizement of the power granted to another branch of government, perfidy, a scheme of peculation. All of these kinds of actions, the framers agreed, would warrant impeachment. Establishing a scheme of oppression, violating the rights of people, all of these actions would fall into that category, high crimes and misdemeanors. We recognize then that that category, high crimes and misdemeanors, is a very broad category that the framers created so as to give to Congress what Alexander Hamilton described in Federalist Number 65 as he wrote about impeachment, what he called the, quote, terrible discretionary authority invested in the terrible discretionary authority vested in Congress. Why would it be terrible? Because it's the action of the most representative branch of the government, closest to the people, having to make that very grave decision. Has a president, for example, so betrayed his oath, subverted the Constitution, abandoned his duties, that it warrants removing that person from office? That's terrible discretion, as to say nobody wants to be asked to do that. It's about the worst thing that could occur in our constitutional republic. But the framers were committed to the inclusion of an impeachment power because the wise old Ben Franklin, 80 years old, 80 years wise, said, without impeachment, quote, there would be no recourse but to assassination. A grave alternative. That's Ben Franklin. And so that helps to explain why nobody in Congress could with glee or joy be asked to consider whether a president, a vice president, a cabinet member has engaged in actions that would warrant impeachment. It is a dreadful time. It's terrible, tragic, discretionary authority. But Hamilton said it has to be done. It has to be done if a president engages in those actions, because the higher loyalty in our nation has to be to the Constitution. Party affiliations, partisan concerns have to be set aside. It is still, at this point, obviously premature to talk about impeachable offenses, having been committed by President Trump. Our question would be, as the days and the weeks and the months go by, and the actions or the offenses begin to pile up, it would be fair for us to ask, at what point is there a case to be made? Where is that tipping point? It's not an easy question to answer because, as we know, partisan politics, political affiliations do play a role in this. Back in 1973 and 74, as Congress began to investigate President Nixon in earnest and learned that he had obstructed justice, that he had violated several laws, that, in fact, he was subverting the Constitution. Members of his own party, Republicans, were reluctant to acknowledge that because they wanted to say that it was the effort by Democrats to derail President Nixon from his election, and this was all a liberal effort to punish this president. It took hearings. It took the realization that, in fact, President Nixon had deceived the American people before members of Congress were willing to act. And the key event in the summer of 1974 was the Supreme Court decision in United States versus Nixon, requiring President Nixon to turn over the taped conversations, the tapes of his conversations in the Oval Office, to the special prosecutor, and that they would be played for the American people. When the court ordered that on July 24, 1974, then Americans, including Republicans, members of his own party, realized that he had been engaging in a cover-up, that he obstructed justice, usurped power, and a number of other offenses. And that's when those Republican leaders, led by Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, Robert Griffin of Michigan, and about 10 others, went to the White House and said, "You must resign because you will be impeached, you will be removed, and no Republican will vote to support you." That was a low moment or a high moment in American history, wasn't it? A high moment because it gave life to what Alexander Hamilton had written in Federalist 65, expressing the hope that people would be able to shed their partisan and political and party affiliation to do what their duty asked of them. When we look at the actions by President Trump, we'll be closely examining some of the very same actions that are being examined by the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller. Has the president obstructed justice? To a growing number of people, the answer is yes. It began by firing FBI Director James Comey. It has followed by actions to interfere with the investigation. Was he involved with the Russians in the election of in his election in 2016? Did he ever say to the Russians, if you can, please do release Hillary Clinton's emails? He said that on national television. Did he engage in any action that would fall into the category of collusion or coordination with the Russians? The Mueller team is investigating that. But what we're lacking so far in comparison to 1974 is an honest-to-goodness effort by our House committees that could live up to the high effort of the committees of Congress in 1974. Because at this juncture, too many members of his party, of President Trump's party, are unwilling to, in fact, roll up their sleeves, call all the relevant witnesses to testify, ask for all the documents that members of the committee want the members to see so they can determine what, in fact, might have occurred. So the House Committee. The House Intelligence Committee is not living up to its responsibilities or duties, in large part because Chairman Devin Nunes of California has been acting very closely, in a very helpful way, to President Trump instead of acting independently. We have three branches of government separated by the Constitution, aiming for independence. But when the chair of the House Intelligence Committee is shunning the concept of independence and, in fact, informing the president of information acquired by the committee so as to aid the president, that is not only a failure to assert its independence, that kind of collusion undermines separation of powers, undermines checks and balances, and undermines the very integrity of the House Intelligence Committee. That frightens me very greatly because then we lose the crucial check on the executive. Whatever your political views might be or partisan affiliations might be, it's in the interest of America to get at the truth. And so all the actions undertaken by Chairman Nunes to delay or to deny an honest-to-goodness pursuit of the truth, of the facts, is very damaging to the United States. That's why we tend to place more emphasis on the Senate Intelligence Committee. That committee has performed at a higher level. But there's no doubt that we rely very greatly on the efforts of independent counsel Robert Mueller. And it strikes me as odd that in a democracy where majoritarianism should govern, where the process, the procedure, the Bill of Rights, all should control how our democracy works, that here we are in this dark hour depending on a single person more than we have ever depended on a single person in the course of American history. That gives me pause. It makes me nervous. But I don't think it's an exaggeration. So the integrity of the investigation conducted by Robert Mueller is critical to the maintenance of American democracy. We should be able to say, let's put all the cards on the table. Let's see everything and determine whether or not President Trump and his campaign team or administration have done anything that have undermined the law, undermined the Constitution, perhaps subverted American constitutional democracy. If he's exonerated, so much the better for Donald Trump. And then he could say, see, I told you so. Do you think he might say that? See, I told you so. It is far too important to permit or to condone or to somehow assist a cover-up. Any action that would obstruct this investigation is a very serious act and a very serious blow against American democracy. And that's why we turn finally then to the question of whether or not President Trump will try to remove the independent counsel. Would he undertake to have him removed? Now, you should know that he may not directly remove Mueller, but it's the number two person at the Justice Department, Rod Rosenstein, who has jurisdiction over Mueller and the investigation. If, in fact, President Trump wants Mueller removed, then he's got to order Ron Rosenstein to remove him. At that point, then Rod Rosenstein assumes the very position that his predecessors, back in 1974, the Attorney General of the United States, Elliot Richardson, when he was ordered by President Nixon to fire the independent counsel, at that point it was Archibald Cox, and Elliot Richardson, who had a great deal of integrity, refused to do it. He was fired. He resigned. That meant then that William Ruckelshaus, the number two person who is the counterpart to Rod Rosenstein, was asked the same question. He refused, and he resigned. And then Nixon found an associate whose name was Robert Bork, and he agreed to do the fire, and he agreed to do the dirty work. So we depend very greatly on the strength of character, the sense of responsibility, the professionalism, the dedication, and the willingness of Rod Rosenstein to allow the investigation to go forward if and when the day comes where President Trump says to Rosenstein, "I want you to fire Mueller." We would wonder how strong is Rosenstein at that point. I would hope that he would refuse, not for partisan reasons, not for political affiliation, but I hope he would refuse in order to fire Mueller because, as I said earlier, America needs to know the truth, whether the person in the White House is there because he colluded or cooperated with the Russians. If Rosenstein should, in fact, refuse and he's fired, then we move down the ladder, so to speak, and Trump has to find someone in the Justice Department to fire Robert Mueller. We would be at the point then where the Saturday night massacre in October of 1973 occurred. Will we have a Saturday night massacre in our time, in this winter, in the spring, in the summer? In a lot of ways, I think it depends on how tightly the noose is drawn around the president's team. So I don't think, ladies and gentlemen, that we've reached the point of ultimate tension. It's very quiet in here. I sense there's tension, but we have not reached the point of tension yet that we will reach if the Mueller investigation is further involved in the investigation of people working in the Oval Office. And that can only mean Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. What actions would President Trump take to protect his son and his son-in-law? We all hear these jokes about in-laws. Well, maybe he doesn't care about Jared, but he surely cares about Donald Jr. And that's what takes us back to that infamous June 2016 meeting where Donald Jr. met with a number of Russians and he met to acquire dirt on Hillary. Is that coordination? Is that working together? Is that collusion? It certainly fits within that category, doesn't it? I'm sure you find all these things that I've had to say tonight to be truly uplifting. Don't you all feel better? Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to stop here and see what questions you might have about this whole process or anything related to what I've had to say. And Kelly, I think, is grabbing the microphone. Kelly, are you going to grab the microphone, or Greg, maybe? You know, often what I have to say puts my audience to sleep. Maybe, Kelly or Greg, are you there? They didn't have an, I know, I've heard the speaker, and I know you need a lot of coffee when this guy is speaking. Until they get here, would you raise your question, please, as loudly as you can, and then I'll repeat it, and we'll get it on the broadcast.
I haven't read the indictment, and I'm not familiar with the mechanisms of social media that much. Could you help us understand how the indictment of influence through social media channels might compare to, say, back when we had newspapers and yellow journalism?
Yes.
Is there
Very good question. Thank you. So if I may paraphrase, there are at least two very good questions here on the floor. One is, how do we describe the impact or influence used by the Russians through social media to interfere with the 2016 election? And how can we draw a parallel? between the use of social media today and the good old days when we relied more on newspapers, or even we had to deal with the practices of yellow journalism. So very good questions. Thank you. So when Robert Mueller indicted the 13 Russians and three Russian organizations for meddling in the election, it had everything to do with violating federal laws that prohibited that kind of meddling. So the evidence, he said, or the indictment, he said, would be found both in the use of social media as well as other actions, including working with people to undermine the election, to sow the seeds of discord. We'll see how that occurs if we ever have a trial. Remember, these people are in Russia, not likely to come visit Idaho anytime because they could be arrested, right? But let's ask ourselves this question. When the United States wants to put a foreigner on trial, it is the White House or the State Department that makes the request to the foreign country, please send John Smith here, or send Radnatovich or Lenin or somebody, if it's a Russian name. We want that person to be extradited. So given the laws of extradition, the request for these people in Russia has to be approved by the President of the United States. So one way to test the willingness of President Trump to support the indictments is for him to contact Russia and ask them to extradite those people who have been indicted. Is that likely? I think it's unlikely, or at least President Trump would resist it. The last thing he wants, given his current position for the last year or so, that the Russians did not meddle, or if they did meddle, they now clearly didn't have any influence, as he doesn't want those people on trial talking about their methods or their sources. So if Congress, back to the committees, the intelligence committees, if Congress wants to help Mueller, Congress will put pressure on the White House to ask for the extradition of those people who have been indicted. That would mean the leadership of the House and the Senate would have to ask and perhaps apply pressure on the White House to do that. If we don't see that being undertaken, then we can have cause for great concern that the leadership in Congress is not willing to support the special prosecutor, the independent counsel's actions. That's one key way to look at it. Will Congress rise to the occasion and require the president to act in that capacity? Now, I like your question for a lot of reasons, one of which is, how do we compare the influence of social media with newspapers or in a bygone era of yellow journalism in terms of the way it can inflame public opinion? Certainly we know that yellow journalism succeeded in inflaming public opinion, which is why it was so denounced by political leaders. But social media has a greater capacity to influence the opinions and behavior of people simply because it can reach millions of people in a matter of very short time. And that makes it all the more menacing, I think. We need an investigation into the ways and means by which the Russians have developed these tools to manipulate and to corrupt social media to advance the cause of Donald Trump in 2016, to hurt Hillary Clinton. And we don't know what the next turn of opinion will be. Will the Russians in the 2018 elections be seeking to aid Democrats, seeking to aid Republicans, some members of both? That's why we have said all along, uncovering the means and the methods by which the Russians meddled in the 2016 election is not a partisan issue, because the day may come when, in fact, the Russians may aid Democrats, maybe next time, and not Republicans. Unfortunately, too many people view this as a partisan issue, watching it through a very narrow political lens. Thank you. Other questions? Kelly or Greg, do we have a microphone this time? Maybe?
I can be loud.
You can raise your voice, and I'll repeat it, but let's see if that mic works. Is it working?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Kelly, could you come down here first, please?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You were a teacher,
so you know how to fill this room with your voice. Absolutely. Now, were you born with that talent, or did you?
I think so.
You think so? Okay. Wonderful. Thank you, Kelly.
What I want to know is the legal or constitutional background for having a special prosecutor.
Excellent. So the question is, what's the legal or constitutional background for having a special prosecutor? An excellent question. So, over the course of American history, on occasion, the Attorney General, the Justice Department, has been asked by Congress or other interested parties to appoint somebody to conduct an investigation. Typically, that's occurred if, in fact, somebody within the executive branch is viewed with some suspicion. And the assumption was that the Justice Department would not possess the necessary independence or objectivity to investigate somebody within their own province. So when we arrived at Watergate, once Congress learned, by following the great journalism being practiced by the Washington Post in particular, that there, in fact, were ties between the break-in of the Watergate Hotel, the Democratic headquarters, and the Nixon White House, it became clear that an investigation of those kinds of leads or possibilities would require an outside counsel. So Congress provided for the appointment of a special counsel by pressuring the president to do so. Nixon felt he couldn't resist, and then President Nixon, ever the cynic, said to his staff, go ahead and appoint Archibald Cox. Cox had been a former Secretary of Labor under John Kennedy. He was close to the Kennedys, a real Democrat. And Nixon said it's okay to appoint Archibald Cox precisely because he believed that he could stonewall any investigation. He was arrogant, and he believed that whatever Archibald Cox might do, it was the case that, in fact, Nixon could outwit him, outsmart him, outlast him. Well, he didn't know how rugged an investigator Archibald Cox was. And that's why when Nixon got to the point in the Saturday Night Massacre, needed Cox to be fired from his perspective, because Cox was hot on the trail, had evidence that Nixon had been involved in the cover-up of the headquarters. After the whole Watergate affair ended, that's when Congress in 1978 passed a statute called the Ethics in Government Act, providing a statutory basis for the appointment of a special counsel so that we wouldn't have to worry about all the politics every time an investigation was in fact necessary. Well, it seemed like a good idea. It had bipartisan support because we had seen how a president had fired the special prosecutor. So we needed a statutory basis. One of the leaders of the passage of that Ethics in Government Act, by the way, was Idaho's own Senator Frank Church, who had been battling Nixon for several years, particularly during the investigation of the CIA, which was behaving in a rogue manner. At any rate, the Special Prosecutor Act, which is the nickname for the Ethics in Government Act, passed in 1978, as I say, had bipartisan support. But when it was used against the Reagan administration, first to investigate the actions of the of the director or the secretary of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, much to the unhappiness of President Reagan. It began to lose its favor, but then it really lost support when the Iran-Contra scandal broke in 1986, and the special prosecutor, a man named Lawrence Walsh, a lifelong Republican, was now investigating President Reagan's role in what became known as the Iran-Contra affair. And if you haven't thought about that lately, haven't thought about that today, let me share a little bit of the crucial background. The Contras in Nicaragua, a right-wing group, was dedicated to overthrowing the democratically elected regime, the Sandinistas. President Reagan had great disdain for the Sandinistas. He thought it was a left-wing group bordering on a communist regime, and he favored the idea of United States assistance to the Contras. Contras wanted to overthrow the Sandinistas. He wanted America to help. Congress was not going to permit it. Congress passed 7 statutes, no less than 7 laws, prohibiting every conceivable form of assistance by America to the Contras. Well, President Reagan had a team, including names you might recall, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, for example. His own national security advisor, Robert McFarland, who ended up taking his life, and a couple of others, and Admiral Poindexter. And what they did was to sell some American missiles to Iran. They then used the money to support the Contras. This was obviously unconstitutional and illegal. Unconstitutional because only Congress can sell the property of the United States, dispose of the property, unless it grants authority to the president to do it. Congress had not granted the president any authority to secretly sell some missiles. And, of course, then the fact that that money was used to aid the Contras violated 7 statutes. When the investigation then began to move forward, it was pretty clear that, in fact, President Reagan was committing not only violations of the statutes, but essentially impeachable offenses. At a cabinet meeting, the Attorney General of the United States, a man named Ed Meese, said at that meeting, "Nobody can talk about what we're doing here, because if word leaks out," he said, "we'll all be hanging by our thumbs from the White House walls, and the president will be impeached." So he swore the cabinet members to secrecy. Well, as the investigation continued from 1986 for the next several years, Lawrence Walsh was hot on the trail. As President Reagan left his presidency, Lawrence Walsh and his team of attorneys interviewed President Reagan, and they were confused. They would interview, they would take a break, they'd huddle in the hallway or in some adjacent room. They didn't know if President Reagan, in denying any knowledge of Iran-Contra, was pulling off the best acting feat of his entire career, or if, in fact, the rumors about his evolving dementia were true and that he really didn't know. So when Lawrence Walsh then continued the investigation after the end of the Reagan presidency and George H.W. Bush became president, Walsh is able to learn about one of those cabinet meetings, because when the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, had left his position under the Reagan administration and deposited his papers with the Library of Congress, journalists began to read those papers, as did Lawrence Walsh and his team of attorneys, and they found Weinberger's notes describing the views and the actions of both President Reagan and then Vice President George H.W. Bush, supporting and encouraging the Contras and the program. This then, these notes, would be used, presumably, by Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh at trial when he, in fact, indicted Caspar Weinberger. And it was expected at trial that Walsh would say, Mr. Secretary, are these your notes? Yes. Is this your handwriting? Yes. Would you read these passages? And he would do it, and it would show that contrary to their public remarks of knowing nothing about Iran-Contra, that both President Reagan and then-President H.W. Bush not only knew about it, they encouraged it and supported it. Those actions would warrant impeachment. That's why on December 24, 1992, George H.W. Bush, having lost his bid for re-election, granted a pardon to Caspar Weinberger and the others involved in the Iran-Contra affair because it spared Caspar Weinberger the need to go to trial, the unfortunate situation of going to trial where he would have testified to the authenticity of his notes. What might have happened out of that? America would have learned that the president and the former vice president had deceived the American public. In his campaign to win election to the presidency in 1988, when Bush ran against Dukakis, when he was asked reporters about his knowledge of Iran-Contra, his standard response was, quote, I was out of the loop. I was out of the loop, meaning he had deceived the American people on the campaign trail. So in the act of pardoning Weinberger, President Bush essentially pardoned himself because Weinberger was the person who would have testified against President Bush. It would have been a very chilling moment for Americans to hear that the former president and the current president had misled the American people about the Iran-Contra affair. At any rate, at the end of that, Republicans were not interested in having a special prosecutor statute. They wanted to repeal it. Democrats, however, said, no, let's keep it. It's a good tool because we've seen how a special prosecutor can use the statute to try to find the truth. So Democrats were a little bit gleeful until Bill Clinton and his involvement with Monica Lewinsky and other actions led to the appointment of a special prosecutor, Ken Starr, whom you know then at the end of his detailed report utilized a little-known provision in the Ethics in Government Act that provided if the special prosecutor finds evidence that the president has committed an impeachable offense, he may make a recommendation to the House of Representatives. That's exactly what Ken Starr did, recommended to the House that Bill Clinton should be impeached. And, of course, that led the House Judiciary Committee in 1998 to vote articles of impeachment against Clinton. He was impeached by the House when the case moved to the Senate for the Senate to decide whether or not President Clinton should be removed from office and perhaps precluded from any further service to the United States. During this trial, the Senate refused to remove him, refused to find him guilty, largely because so much of what Bill Clinton did, his lies, his potential obstruction of justice, spilled from the fact that he was having a cover-up. He was having an affair. He was covering it up. And prosecutors around the country agreed that that people are seldom prosecuted for lying about sexual affairs. And Clinton was then allowed to stay in office. After that, when the law came up for renewal, neither Republicans nor Democrats wanted to renew the independent counsel statute. I like it, as a matter of fact, but you can see for partisan reasons why neither party did. So what we have now is whenever we're going to have a special prosecutor appointed, the Department of Justice goes to a 3-judge panel in Washington and ask for the appointment of a special prosecutor, or in the alternative, and this is what happened here, the DOJ simply appoints somebody to be special prosecutor. It happened to be a person that Donald Trump had actually elevated. So he's sore about that. Yeah. Good question. Where are we? Let's see. Thank you. Greg down here, Daniel, I think, has a question, please.
Thank you. Hi. A novel claim that's been made, especially when there's a congressional inquiry, is for people to say that this may be a question on which the president may at some point invoke executive privilege and therefore I will not answer it. Is there a legal precedent or precedent to this statement, or is there any constitutional argument that permits such a claim?
Thank you. So a very good question about the origins of the doctrine of executive privilege. So let's understand, in our time, the claim of executive privilege is an assertion by the president to withhold materials, documents, tapes, any materials from the requesting party. It might be Congress, it might be a prosecutor, it perhaps could be a court. So what are the origins of this doctrine of executive privilege? I think it'll surprise you to know, number one, that there's nothing in the text of the Constitution involving the claim of executive privilege. Number two, the framers in their debates in the Constitutional Convention in 1787 never discussed the concept of executive privilege. And that number three, by the time that the framers began to convene in Philadelphia, England had already established that the king was responsible to furnish to the House of Commons any information requested by the Commons, that the king had no grounds for refusal. Now, that's important because it means if any of us wants to argue that the Constitution grants the president the power of executive privilege, it means that somehow the framers of the Constitution wanted to give to the newly minted president more power than the dreaded King of England exercised. Hard to believe that the framers would want to do that, and in fact, they did not. In the Constitutional Convention, when discussions occurred about the scope of the congressional power to conduct investigations, it was always assumed that Congress could, in fact, access any information it needed to satisfy its lawmaking power. So you might wonder then, if there's no mention of it in the text, and not only no discussion in Philadelphia, but in fact all the evidence running in the other direction to deny that the president would have the authority, where in the world did this claim of executive privilege come from? The very first time that that phrase, executive privilege, was ever uttered was during the Eisenhower administration in 1954. And that occurred when Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, who was bullying Washington and the nation, lying to the American people about Russians invading the U.S. government, Department of Agriculture, state, and the Pentagon, that when he wanted information about people whom he considered to be involved in actions promoting Russian interests who worked in the Pentagon, Eisenhower said no. And he said, I'm invoking executive privilege. That was the first time that those words were conjoined. Americans applauded when Ike invoked executive privilege to refuse to give information to Senator McCarthy because he was standing up to the monster. But little did we know at that time that once the genie was out of the bottle, that it would be available to subsequent presidents to use and abuse, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. So that's why when the Watergate investigation led to the point where we learned at the hearings conducted by the Senate Select Committee on Watergate, we heard from a Nixon aide named Lyman Butterfield that, in fact, there were tapes that that would record all the conversations in the Oval Office, a question which, a moment of great drama in the hearing room when a member of the Senate would ask, and this was the very famous Howard Baker of Tennessee, who would ask of every witness from the administration, Nixon White House, famously, what did the president know and when did he know it? Very famous question. Lyman Butterfield, who worked inside the Nixon White House, would say, I don't know the answer to the question, but the answer will be on the tapes. Tapes? What tapes? And you could have dropped that pin in that very quiet room. Lyman Butterfield then explained, well, when President Nixon came into office, that in fact he had determined that his presidency would be so important to scholars in future generations that he wanted a full record to be available. And so he installed a taping device that was automatically triggered by the sound of a voice. Everything was recorded. I suppose as time goes by, you forget that your conversations are being recorded. And shortly after the Watergate break-in, when his White House counsel, John Dean, informed Nixon about the burglars and said to President Nixon, they'll take the fall. They won't link to the White House, but they want something. Nixon said, what do they want? They want hush money. They want some money. How much do they want? The reply was $1 million, and there on tape, the President of the United States said, I think I can get $1 million for those guys to take the fall. That became the smoking gun tape, which was revealed when the Supreme Court, in the Nixon case, said that the tapes would have to be given up by President Nixon, and then they were played, and we all learned what President Nixon had done, what he had said and done. Trying to fight that, first at the federal district court, Richard Nixon had invoked the doctrine of executive privilege to refuse to turn over information requested by the congressional committees and then by the special prosecutor, who by this time was Leon Jaworski, who had replaced Archibald Cox after Cox had been fired. And Jaworski now, like Cox, wanted the information. The Nixon White House would not surrender the information, so Jaworski went to federal district court, and the federal judge surprised a lot of people when he ordered Nixon to turn over the tapes, denying the claim of executive privilege. Richard Nixon had asserted that he enjoyed a, quote, absolute executive privilege on grounds of separation of powers, and that he alone had responsibility for maintaining our national security, and therefore he alone would determine what information was safe to turn over to other departments. So the federal judge rejected that, ordered Nixon to turn over the tapes. Then we wondered, when that order came down, would Nixon cooperate or not? And in that interim period, this is in July now of 74, that's when the Nixon administration was beginning to unravel, and Nixon administration appealed to the Supreme Court, and a unanimous 8-0 decision, Berger wrote the opinion, striking down or rejecting Nixon's claim of an absolute executive privilege, holding that the president enjoys a limited executive privilege, but it does not apply in cases where defendants, this case the Watergate defendants, have a Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial, which includes demanding evidence which may be exculpatory, helping them. And so in a criminal matter, the claim of executive privilege, whatever the scope of it was, could not override the Sixth Amendment right of defendants. And then Nixon had to turn over the tapes. We worried for a time whether he would surrender the tapes. That's why the Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, a lifelong Republican and friend of Nixon, quietly placed a call to the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying, if you receive an order from the president to deploy troops, do not follow that order unless it comes from me. What was this old friend of Nixon fearing? A coup. Coups don't happen in America. Military coups happen in Latin America and Asia and the Middle East, not in the United States. It would have been different if the Secretary of Defense had been a hardline liberal, an original Nixon hater. Nothing of the sort. Pretty frightening moment. Anyway, you know the rest of the story. He turned over the tape. So what about the ruling by the court that the president enjoys a limited executive privilege? Many scholars believe that was an error because, as I told you before, there's nothing in the text asserting the president has an executive privilege, nothing in the convention debates. So this, to many of us, I'm in this circle, believe that the court engaged in judicial activism when it created for the president a constitutional power that was not founded in the Constitution. We often hear of this charge of judicial activism against the courts when courts uphold so-called liberal positions. But what this means is it can also, the court can engage in it to promote what we would call conservative causes, if that's even fair. So I think the court created a power that's not grounded in the Constitution. Well, you might wonder, well then, what about when aides to the president are asked by the president to give advice, confidential advice? Because presidents and their supporters often want to say, if the president cannot insist that those conversations are confidential and will be maintained confidential, then he'll never get good advice, right? That's always the argument for executive privilege. But we know from a long line of people who have worked for the president that the possibility that their conversations would not be kept confidential never stopped them from providing advice to the president. People like to be asked to give advice. Well, is there no privilege? Yes. The answer is there is a privilege, but it's not constitutionally based. It would be similar to the old common law doctrines of privilege relationships between attorney-client or priest-penitent or doctor-patient. That's the kind of protection, but not on a constitutional basis. Is there any foundation for the claim of executive privilege? But when President Eisenhower let that genie out of the bottle, every president, presidents of both parties, have asserted executive privilege. I think it undercuts the great need for transparency in our government, and it undercuts the ability to hold governmental officials accountable. So the court, I think, as I say, created that claim. So Daniel, you ask a very important historical legal question. That's my view on that. Thank you. Where are we? Greg, let's come down here. Bill has a question, please. And then we're running out of time almost. Please.
As you're talking about that, what came to my mind is presidential pardons. Where in the world did that come from? And how could anybody give a presidential pardon to himself?
Great question. Very timely question.
And to members of his family. And let's just stop there.
Thank you. Those are very important questions. So the framers' decision to create a pardon power was a function of their understanding that across history in many, many countries, including in England, the governmental officials had enjoyed the power to grant a pardon to overturn miscarriages of justice. The King of England was able to exercise a sweeping pardon power for many, many centuries in those cases where judges might or juries might make very unjust, might deliver unjust decisions, and instead of having people suffer as a victim of injustice, somebody was available to correct the miscarriage of justice, right the wrong, so to speak, and grant a pardon to the person. This goes all the way back to Roman law and other legal systems. So the framers, who were keen students of history, very learned, determined that in our system we needed to have a pardon power. The question is, who would possess that pardon power? Their first thoughts, as they discussed it in the Constitutional Convention, was to grant that pardon power to Congress. Why? Because they believed that it would be hard for Congress to exercise the pardon power in an arbitrary way because there'd be so many participants who could discuss and debate the issues. But it occurred to the framers that a problem arose if they were going to vest the pardon power in Congress. What was that problem? They knew from history, and they knew particularly from Shays' Rebellion, which occurred in the early fall of 1786, that there are occasions where it's necessary to offer a pardon as a way of ending a rebellion. And Congress, they understood, would not be in session all the time. The president would be there. If they granted the pardon power to Congress, and we had something like Shays' Rebellion, which involved, you may recall, an uprising by farmers in the western part of Massachusetts in 1786, when courts were foreclosing on homes and farms, and the only way to end the rebellion was for the governor of Massachusetts to grant a pardon to everybody, all the farmers saying, lay down your pitchforks, come home, nobody's going to be prosecuted. That ended the rebellion. But absent the ability to grant a pardon, there may not have been an effective or possible way to end that rebellion. People might know they were going to go to their deaths if they were captured. The framers then realized that there might be moments in America where the ability to offer a timely pardon would be important. Thus, they could no longer vest that power in Congress. Well, they then reluctantly turned to the president, but that gave them great pause because they knew historically that English kings had often abused the pardon power for their own aims, for their own financial interests. Yes, they could be bribed to issue a pardon for their own political interest. When one of the kings wanted to raise an army to make war on another country, they went into debtor's prison, and the king said, all of you, if you pay me some money, I will release you from debtor's prison. But of course, nobody would be in debtor's prison if they had money to pay their bills. So that's when the king said, okay, I'm going to release you, and you pay me later. That was the origin, I think, of the layaway plan that American shoppers used to utilize. I'm just guessing here. So the framers, wary of the possible abuse of the pardon power by an American president because they were familiar with history, wondered, how are we going to constrain the presidential pardon power? That's when, and the convention, they said, if a president violates the pardon power, abuses the pardon power, he may be impeached. And that would, they believe, constrain the exercise of the pardon power. And Hamilton had offered another argument, and he said, with all the eyes of the nation on that one person, the president, he would not dare to abuse his power because he would be caught red-handed. So historically, the pardon power has been exercised pretty judiciously, not particularly controversially, until the Civil War, when President Lincoln and then President Johnson granted a pardon in the form of an amnesty to hundreds of thousands of Confederate soldiers. Lincoln, because he was trying to rebuild the Union, and he knew the only way to do that would be to grant an act of mercy, sparing the Confederate soldiers perhaps punishment. And so that was somewhat controversial, but most people recognize it was necessary to rebuild the nation. It was controversial again to some extent when some deserters after World War I were granted pardons by President Woodrow Wilson. The same thing happened after World War II. It happened when Jimmy Carter pardoned quote-unquote draft dodgers after the Vietnam War. But it never really caught the attention of the nation and upset Americans to a high degree until Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon after Nixon had resigned the presidency. And that's when people believed there must have been some deal cut between Jerry Ford, vice president, ascending to the presidency upon the resignation of Richard Nixon. And people were very angry because as soon as he became president, Gerald Ford took the step to go before the House Judiciary Committee, where he was asked by the chair, a woman named Elizabeth Holtzman from New York, are you going to grant a pardon to the president? It was very much on the minds of many. His answer was no, it would be premature to pardon the president before trial, and the American people would never stand for it. Less than a month later, we opened the papers in the morning, huge headline, Ford pardons Nixon. When he granted the pardon, President Ford did so, because he believed the nation could not move forward because we were still consumed by Watergate, paralyzed by Watergate. Congress couldn't work. People were wondering what was going to happen to Nixon. So he said in a nationally televised address that he was granting a pardon so that America could begin to heal again. And he also said the Nixon family has suffered enough. When he said that in September 1974 in this nationally televised address, he said to the American people, quote, ladies and gentlemen, my fellow Americans, our great national nightmare is over. That was at the time when one of those first movies involving Freddy Krueger was coming out. Wasn't that our real nightmare? Nixon was being compared to Freddy Krueger. At any rate, Ford was heavily criticized for it. It probably cost him his election bid in 1976 when he narrowly lost to Jimmy Carter because polls showed that Americans by some 60% were unhappy with Ford's pardon. Had he not pardoned Nixon, Jerry Ford probably would have been elected president. That was the most controversial effort. And then we had another major controversy, as I said earlier, when H.W. Bush pardoned Cap Weinberger and others in Iran-Contra. To be bipartisan about this, when Bill Clinton pulled an all-nighter in his last night as president, pardoned his brother, pardoned a lot of people, pardoned people, a man who had given money to Democratic causes and his own presidential library, which didn't smell good because this person had fled the country after violating U.S. export laws in oil. He was divorced, and he fled to Switzerland, but his wife, and this is rare, his wife loved him so, she pleaded with Bill Clinton to grant a pardon to her ex-husband. His name was Mark Rich, and she then wrote a big check for hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democratic Party and the Clinton White House. It smelled so badly, the optics were so bad, that the Justice Department started an investigation. It was in the Southern District of New York. The prosecutor investigated for 6 to 8 months, found that it didn't smell very good, but she couldn't quite find a criminal violation. So, to bring this to a close, because this is a big topic, I've written on it, I like it very much. The reality is that the pardon power is always available for abuse. And we never know when it's going to be abused, and you asked the right question now. President Trump, several months ago, raised the possibility he could pardon himself if he's indicted. There would be no justification for a president to grant a self-pardon because it would put the president above the law, right? And the very essence of, quote, the rule of law at the time of the framing of the Constitution was about subordinating the executive to the rule of law. So it would make hash of the idea of the rule of law. And if the president dared to do it, then undoubtedly we would need a court battle where the court decides that the president can't do that. But, Bill, there's nothing to stop the president from pardoning a daughter, a son, a son-in-law, or any of his other aides if they are, in fact, indicted or near indictment by Mueller. And that's why, in this particular case, if that were to happen as a means of obstructing justice, Congress would be called upon to exercise its powers of impeachment, to cry foul and impeach the president for doing that. And then we would have court battles designed to overturn the presidential pardon. You might wonder, on what basis would a court overturn a presidential pardon? The grounds for doing so are very, very limited, because the pardon power is the most imperial of the president's power by design, to correct miscarriages of justice, for example. So the courts, in only a very few rulings, have held that a president's pardon could be subjected to judicial review. In 1926, in a case called Ex parte Grossman, Chief Justice Taft wrote the opinion and said, well, if the president should announce that he's opening the jailhouse doors across the country, then judicial review could proceed. That would be an abuse of power. Or if the president, and this occurred during the Nixon administration, if a president were bent on imposing an unconstitutional condition in the case of a conditional pardon, then the courts could review it to determine if the condition itself might have violated one of the rights or liberties of the person who received the pardon. Conditional pardon has been used historically. Consider this. During Woodrow Wilson's administration, Eugene V. Debs, a great labor organizer, socialist, World War I dissident, was arrested for giving speeches, despite the fact that he had a First Amendment right to do so, sent to prison for 13 years. Fellow progressives pleaded with Woodrow Wilson, come on, he's one of our own. You need to pardon him. Wilson would not, because he didn't like the fact that Debs was criticizing his wartime policy. It fell ultimately to President Harding, a deeply conservative man, to grant a pardon to Debs, but he did it on a condition. Debs was in prison in Atlanta, and he said, I'll grant him a conditional pardon, but I want to meet that fellow first, so he has to come to the White House. There's a conditional pardon. Lots more to say about this. I think it can become relevant. Your question, I think, can be even more mature, more ripe in a weeks or months as we see whether or not President Trump wants to assert the pardon power on behalf of family members or aides or perhaps himself. What a movie that would make. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate your questions, and we'll send out an email in the next week or so announcing when our next series will begin. I hope you'll be interested. So in the meantime, take care. Long live the Republic. Thank you. Thank you.